Catholics in the Kansas City St. Joseph Diocese are waiting to find out if the Pope is going to remove their bishop. Robert Finn is the only American bishop convicted in state court of shielding a sexually abusive priest. Bishop Finn is also the focus of a rare Vatican investigation. Frank Morris of member station KCUR reports that the debate over the controversial bishop is splitting the diocese.
A Catholic bishop normally governs pretty much unchecked in his diocese. Only the Pope can dislodge a bishop. And each time Catholics celebrate Mass in Kansas City, they pray for Bishop Robert Finn right after they pray for Pope Francis.
Our Holy Father Francis, our Bishop Robert.
But some Catholics here, like Deacon David Byersmith, refuse to go along.
When the priest says that, you know, you're supposed to say it with him. But I'll leave that out. I just don't say it.
Why?
Because he's not my bishop, as far as I'm concerned.
Much of the discontent has to do with an incident 4 years ago. A computer technician found hundreds of lewd photos of little girls on a priest's laptop. The priest was Sean Radigan, and it wasn't the first sign that he was a pedophile. But Bishop Finn didn't tell authorities. Instead, he sent Radigan to a therapist, switched his job, and asked him to stay away from children. Radigan didn't, and months later, a diocese official did finally report him. Radigan was sentenced to 50 years in prison for child pornography, and Finn drew 2 years probation for shielding him.
So we have a guilty verdict from a judge. Yes, he did fail. There had to be more.
Jeff Weiss was just a regular parishioner, not an activist. That is, not until this.
What I was looking for was, what is the church's response to this? What is the bishop's response?
The church set up new protocols for reporting child abuse and hired a former federal prosecutor to investigate the Radigan mess. But Finn stayed on as bishop. And so Weiss launched an online petition asking the Pope to remove him. It's drawn more than 260,000 signatures. Others sent the same message in different ways. And then last fall, the Vatican dispatched an archbishop here to investigate.
Out of the blue, I got a call, and they were arranging meetings for the archbishop to talk with people about the Bishop Finn issues. Could I come?
That's Jim Kokomo, who had a good vantage point on the issue. He led a board for the diocese set up to advise Bishop Finn on sexual abuse issues. And while Kokomo calls Finn a wonderful, holy man, he can't fathom why he failed to report Radigan to authorities.
Oh my gosh, in this environment today, when the church is moving to protect its children, how could that happen?
A lot of people are asking the same question. James Connell, a priest and canon lawyer in Milwaukee, says Finn broke protocols the church set up after the huge sexual abuse crisis in 2002. Even high-ranking church officials have publicly weighed in. Cardinal Sean O'Malley from Boston, a close advisor to Pope Francis, addressed the Finn issue on 60 Minutes.
It's a question that the Holy See needs to address urgently.
And there's a recognition.
There's a recognition of that.
From Pope Francis.
From Pope Francis.
Pope Francis recently demoted Finn's closest ally in Rome, a conservative cardinal named Raymond Burke. But Finn still has plenty of support here in Kansas City.
Well, I love Bishop Finn.
John Perk, a recently ordained deacon in the Kansas City St. Joe Diocese, holds traditional Catholic views of marriage, birth control, abortion, and theology, same as Finn. It's a belief system that Perk says reveals the deity of Jesus.
Now, a lot of people have a problem with that, just like they had a problem with Jesus. And so the problems that Jesus encountered, this bishop encounters.
Perk says Finn faced a real dilemma over Father Radigan. He says the bishop had conflicting advice and notes that Radigan tried to kill himself when his lewd photographs came to light.
I think the bishop did the best that he could have done with the information that he had, having to balance mercy and justice with a man who was suicidal.
American Catholics are looking to see how the Vatican balances the traditional autonomy of bishops with the need to better address the church's ongoing sexual abuse issue, and who the Pope wants to lead the diocese in Kansas City. For NPR News, I'm Frank Morris.
New York Times columnist Roger Cohen's family history covers a lot of ground, literally. His ancestors lived in Lithuania. Then, starting with his grandparents, the moving began.
My parents were born in South Africa, and they were immigrants in the UK, where I was born. And then when I was an infant, we went back to South Africa for a couple of years and then moved to Britain, where I mainly grew up. So in each of the past four generations, the family has moved. Lithuania, South Africa, London. I'm now an American citizen and consider New York to be home.
Cohen's new family memoir is called The Girl from Human Street. The girl in that title is Cohen's mother, a focus for much of the book. She died in 1999 after a long battle with depression.
My mother, shortly after we emigrated, immediately after my younger sister's birth, broke down. She had what was then called post-puerperal psychosis, now generally called postpartum depression. And she had insulin shock treatment since completely discredited. This is in the late 50s in England, and electroshock treatment. It was only in researching the book that I finally was able to put dates and times on this. And now know, for example, that on August 1, 1958, one day before my third birthday, she had this treatment. But she came back to the family after an intermittent absence of a couple of years, and a great effort was put into preserving an appearance of normality. And I was not aware, consciously aware, of what had happened to my mother until in my late teens she began to become mentally unstable again and was manic depressive for the rest of her life. First tried to commit suicide when I was 22. And I suppose a genesis of The Girl from Human Street, Arun, was it was a box in the attic, and in it were my mother's suicide notes, and my dad was a doctor, and there was a pretty detailed chronology of what had happened, and there was a family tree that he'd obviously made in a moment of desperation with black dots next to every family member who had suffered from manic depression, and there were more relatives with black dots than without them. And I began to think about how this family condition had been hidden within my own family, and then there was a wider story of our displacements with each generation and the trauma, if you like, of losing a home, of upheaval, of beginning again.
Can you talk about growing up in South Africa? Because you were in kind of an unusual position. You were sort of an English-Jewish family in South Africa in a, kind of an interesting time.
Yeah, well, my parents were South African Jews. They come from Lithuania. They grew up there. My dad came to England as a young doctor at the end of World War II and then went back. And he abhorred apartheid. He was actually the dean of the last black house within the University of the Witwatersrand in Johannesburg. And then he saw how, as a result of apartheid, black students were no longer able to attend. And that, for him, was the last straw. I lived there as an infant and then would go back every year. And there was always this faint menace at the horizon. The blacks were going to rise up and sweep away these beautiful homes where I stayed in Johannesburg. And I remember cousins saying to me, "Enjoy the swimming pool. Next year, they'll be red with blood." And I didn't quite get it. You know, sometimes I would sit on the wrong bench or wander into the wrong place because I was part of South Africa, but I wasn't from there. And, of course, one of the particularities of apartheid was that blacks were banished, except in the most intimate of settings, the home, the family. More or less every white family had black staff, and I would wonder why these utensils were set apart, and I would see them going to sleep in these little concrete outhouses with their baleful single windows. So there was this combination of intimacy, of closeness, and of threat, fear, menace always out there. And it gave me a profound abhorrence of this evil. You know, I spend a lot of time in the Middle East. I don't think Israel practices apartheid. Some people, when it comes to the Palestinians, some people use that phrase. But there are echoes. You know, when you're in the West Bank and you're on a road and it says only for Jews, only for settlers, only for Israelis and not for Palestinians, those echoes are there. And it's one of the reasons why I'm a Zionist who believes very strongly that Zionism must involve two states for two peoples.
You and your family had been through various upheavals, various new homes, and you come to America. Now, America is a place we like to think where it's easier to assimilate than a lot of other places in the world.
It is easier, Arun. That's why I love it. That's why I became an American citizen. You can't imagine what a relief it was as a Jew to arrive in New York City. And the bright star, as I think I put it in the book, of immigration, of moving on, is new opportunity. And its black sun is loss. The loss of a home, the loss of a country, the loss of a community. And for some people, the project of beginning again is overwhelming. It's too much. That was the case for my mother. Even in America, for me, it's hard. But even the most open of European societies has nothing like the openness of the United States, which is a country that is still, in my view, endlessly enriched by immigration.
Roger Cohen is a columnist for The New York Times. His new memoir is called The Girl from Human Street. Roger Cohen, real pleasure speaking with you. Thank you.
Thank you, Arun.
At Duke University today, students gathered on the lawn outside the campus chapel to listen to the Muslim call to prayer. But that prayer did not come from the chapel bell tower. Earlier this week, the university said Muslim students could use the bell tower, but then backtracked after getting threats. Rima Kreis of member station WUNC reports.
Allahu Akbar, Allah.
Hundreds of people stood on Duke University's campus today in the shadow of a 210-foot Gothic chapel. That voice is coming from a wireless speaker in front of the chapel. Had things gone differently, the chant would have come from the top of the bell tower, not the bottom. Imam Adil Zeb is Duke's Muslim chaplain.
I would be more happy if it happened the original way. I think many of the Muslim community would be more happy about that. At the same time, from my theological point of view, things happen according to what God wants to happen.
Duke reversed course yesterday. Initially, the private university said Muslim students could give a 3-minute prayer from the chapel bell tower every Friday. But then came the threats, says Duke's spokesman Mike Schoenfeld.
They were serious, they were credible, and they're something that is very important for the university to recognize.
There are more than 700 people on Duke's campus who identify as Muslim. Duke had one of the first university imams in the country. Schoenfeld says this weekly event was supposed to be about unity.
Both the number and the tone of the call, just sort of random over the transom calls that were coming in, were pretty loud and pretty nasty.
One of the loudest was from evangelist Franklin Graham. He's the son of Reverend Billy Graham. Here he is on WSOC-TV in Charlotte.
We as Christians are being marginalized, and Islam, which is not a religion of peace, and there's nothing peaceful about Islam at all. Just look at the Middle East.
On Facebook and on TV interviews, Graham urged donors not to support Duke. The university says it didn't bow to that pressure, but some students think otherwise. Back in front of the chapel, hundreds of people stood by the Muslims, including Indira Odafia. She's a master's student at Duke's Divinity School and a Christian.
Even if I may not understand the fullness of the Islam faith, it does not mean that I'm not called to be hospitable and be open and welcome those type of experiences here.
Ahmed Jatan is a Duke alum and a former president of the Muslim Student Association.
I hope that Muslim students on campus are able to stand up for themselves and show that we can be visible on this campus, we can feel safe on this campus, and also to tie that struggle with all the other struggles going on in the United States right now for other marginalized communities.
On campus, people are worried about Duke's handling of the situation and what it means to religious freedom at universities across the country. For NPR News, I'm Rima Kreis in Durham, North Carolina.
Many American churches are doing everything they can to attract new generations of parishioners. And often, that means less traditional organ music and Christian hymns. But the organist at the West Auburn Congregational Church in Auburn, Maine, is as popular as ever. His name is Charles Marshall, and he celebrates his 70th year on the keyboards with the release of his new CD at the age of 86. Since World War II, Mr. Marshall has rarely missed a service. And as Maine Public Radio's Susan Sharon reports, he has no intention of retiring anytime soon.
Every Sunday morning, several dozen parishioners settle into wooden pews in their 200-year-old church as Charles Marshall opens worship with a musical prelude. And every week, it's a different selection. Marshall was a pianist for his high school chorus in 1945 when his music teacher asked him to play the organ for an upcoming concert at a church that had no piano.
I says, I can't play the organ. I've never tried it, never seen one hardly. He says, you go up and practice, and he says, we'll have the concert, and we did.
Despite his initial reluctance, Marshall's been playing the organ in this same church ever since. He estimates he's outlasted 30 ministers, played the organ at hundreds of weddings and funerals, and memorized almost as many hymns.
He's excellent, and if he makes a mistake, he doesn't like it at all.
Mary Bucher has been a member of the church for more than 60 years. Years ago, she sang with Marshall in the choir and knows how seriously he takes his role. Sometimes, says Bucher, it's as if the music comes to him from God.
One day he just made a little mistake and he started crying, and he said he didn't know if that was going to be it or not. And we're going, no, please. We just love to have him here.
The church choir may be gone, but parishioners like Richard Creighton and others are often called upon to sing.
Go tell it on the mountain.
At the West Auburn Congregational Church, Reverend John Williams says music is as important as the spoken word. Williams has also been coming to this church since he was a young boy.
You know, the more music people hear, the more inspired they are, the more passionate they are, and I think people embrace that.
For Charles Marshall, that passion is traditional Christian music, even as much of the rest of the world is now embracing a more contemporary style.
The type of music today in most churches is they want to get an orchestra or a band or something like that and follow the ways of the world. I don't think that should be any part of worship.
After 70 years of playing the church organ, Marshall says he's occasionally considered retirement, but the close-knit congregation, who are mostly elderly themselves, won't hear of it.
That's true. I'd like to slow down, but they won't let me.
For most of his life, there's only one thing that Marshall has loved more than playing church music, and that's his wife, June. They've been married for 60 years, and Marshall says his music wouldn't be possible without June as his muse. For NPR News, I'm Susan Sharon in Auburn, Maine.